Blog Talk Radio.
Bi-weekly instead of every week, giving us a chance to be able to work on, building the show up into a more informative show and to be able to bring better content. That's going to be a slight change that's going to take place. I think next week we will do a special because it is Juneteenth, but stay tuned for that. Today's show is on critical race theory and the attempt to keep white America blind. Yeah, that's what I said, the attempt to keep white America blind. But before I get too deep into that, we want to do some general political housekeeping items here for the first couple of minutes of the show and talk about some of the things that are going on around us locally here in Georgia. As we know, the political engine that runs the state of Georgia is the city of Atlanta. And the city of Atlanta has its mayoral elections this year. All the city council seats are up, as it is always like that. And shit has got interesting. Now, most of us kind of had a feeling that, after the remarks that Kasim made about a month and a half ago, on the radio, we started assuming that Kasim was going to jump in the race. And then seeing Keisha drop out, that increased that probability. And now what do we see? Kasim Reed is back. And to be honest with you, this is going to make this a very, very interesting race. Because as we was on the cusp, I believe, of having major sweeping reform in the city of Atlanta, because we were going to have a clean slate of candidates that were not connected to the normal power structure of the city. Now we got the old guard rearing his head in the form of Kasim Reed. It's going to get bloody. I posted on Facebook yesterday, winter is coming, people. And then, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, everybody need to be calling their banner because it's going to be a fight. And if you ain't ready to throw punches and get deep down and dirty in these city of Atlanta elections, you might as well get ready to drop out because it's just the nature of what has happened in the city over the last year and all of the posturing that is going on. It's going to be ugly. Be prepared. I don't care if you run for city council. It's going to affect your race. Be prepared to throw punches because somebody going to get squirmed and going to try to out-Kasim, even if they're a little chap. And we got to be prepared for it. I mean, so this is going to be a really, really interesting thing to watch, is how that's going to be probably all eyes during the summer, is how Atlanta's race going to roll. Some other things that are going on, and it's connected to Atlanta, in ways that, and it's actually happening all over the state. It's not just Atlanta, and it's just not even just Georgia. It's across the country. There's an uptick in crime. We don't know if it's, you know, we've been pent up energy for the last year because of COVID, but we need to really pay attention, because there was a lot of momentum toward police reform. And if crime keeps going the way it's going, there's going to be a push toward law and order. And we cannot afford not to have police reform, but at the same time, we have to realize that we actually have freaking criminals out there. And some of it has to deal with, you know, the income inequality that we have in our country, that makes people feel like they have to go out here and do what they got to do to make ends meet. But let's have this understood. There is a certain psychological footprint on certain people's mind that pushes them toward criminality. It has nothing to do with their environmental upbringing. We've seen some of the most heinous criminals come out of poor neighborhoods. We don't see some of our most heinous criminals come out of rich neighborhoods. There's this thing called evil, and you have to deal with it. And there needs to be people with guns who are willing to kill to deal with it. Now, how do we balance that and not make everybody be a part of this small subset? But that's another show, but it's something that you need to be thinking about. As we've got people running around still talking about defunding the police, I don't think that's going to be a very popular sentiment coming into the municipal elections that we have in Georgia this year. That's not going to be a very popular sentiment. We got to think about reimagining that messaging, which I've never really been a total fan of from the get-go. But we have to, you know, reimagine that. And what does it really look like? And a lot of the stuff that goes into our policing policy actually deals with some of the stuff we're probably going to talk about today, dealing with the whole conversation around critical race theory. Because I've been doing a lot of reading even before we start talking about critical race theory, just getting an understanding and letting my mind evolve around the new information that's coming in. And it is truly scary to have to relearn what you thought was canon. And know it to be true, because you're sitting there living with the consequences of what's going on. So just be mindful that we have to be prepared to have some really hard conversations over the next couple of months over this whole thing. Now, we have scheduled this morning to talk about critical race theory. Two citizens of Georgia who are from the education space. And I'm hoping technology is going to hold up today, and make sure that we're able to make sure these callers are able to connect. But we have from Fayette County, we have Leonard Pressburg, who is a good friend of the show and member of the school board down in Fayette County, Georgia. And we also have 2018 Democratic nominee for Georgia State School Superintendent and former president of the National PTA, Otha Thornton, who will be calling me in later in the show to talk about this subject. Because it's important. And the thing is that, and this is my opinion, is that this information isn't new information, okay? From my research and what I've been doing for the show, this is something that has been taught, being taught at advanced levels in academia for quite some time. I mean, we've all probably seen the videos on television, on YouTube, rather. There's a white professor, I can't remember her name right now, who asked the question to the white students, who is willing to live a life like the black people in this country live? Raise your hand. And nobody raises their hand. And then she asked the question again. Who in here wants to live the lives that black people have to live in this country every day? Raise your hand. And again, no one raises their hand. And she made a statement that just chills my soul. She said, from the fact that none of you want to raise your hand to live their lives, you know what that's like. And none of you want to live that way. None of you want to live that way. So you know it's wrong. And everybody's sitting there looking. They're like, oh, shit, she right. But the question is, what you going to do about it? And critical race theory is putting that forefront. See, whereas it used to have to be somebody that was, you know, working in master's and doctorate programs to understand and learn this theory, it is now trickling down to the masses. And we know, even as a part of that theory, that keeping white people oblivious to the system that is set up around them is key to that. So how do we change that? How do we make America better? Or, as you know, the president said, how do we build back better in terms of racial harmony? One of the things we have to first do is we have to admit that there was a crime committed in this country. And we can't muddy the waters. We got to speak it in its full truth, in the actualizations of what happened. So we got our first guest cousin called in. Good morning, Leonard.
Morning. How you guys doing?
I'm doing fine, doing fine. It's just me this morning. It's just me. It's just me and you, just me and you.
Okay.
But I was just getting the listeners, prep on what, you know, critical race theory was about, but I want you to give an explanation. First, introduce yourself, because I don't know if I did a proper thing as I was doing the housekeeping of the show. First, tell everybody who you are, what you do, and the spaces you occupy.
Sure. Well, glad to Glad to be here. My name is Leonard Pressburg. I have served on the Fayette County School Board for the last 10 years. When I was first appointed to the Fayette County School Board, I became the first county-level Democratic official in, you know, about a generation, and we've seen some great changes. I've also had the privilege of serving for a time as the chair of the Fayette County Democratic Committee. You know, had a met Scott a long time ago, I think Dr. Rad or something like that. So that's me. I've been on the school board, fighting a good fight, for a while. And I represent, the northern part of Fayette County, in a district that was created in, 2016, by the federal court in a Voting Rights Act, case that went on here in the 2010s, early 2010s. So, good introduction.
Okay.
What I missed? Anything?
You good. So, when I put out the call for folks to come on this show to talk about critical race theory, I actually had a lot of educators who chimed in but were scared to actually come on the show. Because they were like, look, I believe this, this, and this, but I don't know how my school district is going to feel about me saying what I got to say. So a lot of them have a lot of opinions about this. And I'm really glad that somebody from particularly a school board, you know, had the courage to get in some, to fight the good fight and possibly get in some good trouble. But tell our listeners, how you see critical race theory.
So, you know, critical race theory has developed into, you know, through an orchestrated campaign, it has developed into sort of today's Fox News talking point. I think if you go back and do some research, you know, 6 months ago, no one knew what critical race theory was. Today, everyone's talking about it, but I'm still not sure anyone knows what it is. Started as a, you know, legal academic theory in terms of analyzing law and policy in terms of historic systematic racism in the United States. And so whether you're, you know, looking at any particular area, whether it's housing or criminal justice or, you know, pretty much anywhere you look, you can go back and trace a long history of racist de facto and de jure policies. And critical race theory is looking and seeing how that history of racist policies continues to impact what we're doing today. And, you know, but it is instead, you know, going from this sort of academic theory that was talked about by a small number of scholars in graduate schools and law schools, you know, it's become the big talking point because, you know, being racist is unfortunately still an issue that a lot of people can rally around.
Right.
I just read this book called The
You're there?
Sort of the metaphor for the whole. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You cut out just as you got ready to talk about the book you read and what was called. You could tell us again what was
the
book.
Yeah, so the book is called The Sum of Us by Heather McGee.
Okay.
And it is sort of an analysis of, you know, historical racist policies in all sorts of different areas you know, where the theme is that in general, whites will look at racist issues as a zero-sum game where,
right.
you know, if we're trying to make things fair, that means I'm losing, right? We help black kids get into UGA, it means my kid's not, right? Limited resources and we're fighting over them. And, you know, she traces this history of racism, uses the metaphor of the swimming pool, you know, in the 50s, all sorts of communities all over the country were deciding that we should have these grand public swimming pools. And the minute blacks won their right to participate in these, you know, public things, communities literally filled their investments with concrete. Decided no one should swim if, you know, they had to share their pool. And it's just an analysis of, you know, policy after policy and how, you know, when we start thinking of it as zero sum, everyone gets hurt.
You know,
so
I
anyway,
was,
so
I
just keep...
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so, you know, you talked about teachers and being scared. I just came back from the Georgia School Boards Association conference. And there has been a lot of work among school boards and school staff and a lot of places. You'll hear buzzwords like social emotional learning and equity and, you know, a lot of work around this idea that we've got to make sure that every kid who comes to school, regardless of, you know, race, religion, economics, whatever, feels safe, feels connected, sees themselves in the staff and decision makers, sees themselves and their community in the curriculum, and you know, and this whole outrage over critical race theory is scaring educators out of doing that work. You know, when the State Board of Education says, you know, make sure no one ever feels bad in history class. You know, I don't know how you teach history and worry about kids' feelings all the time.
You know, but I, you, the thing that gets me on that one is because I've never, and I went to a very diverse high school. I mean, I went to Shamrock High at Shamrock. And at Shamrock, I think we had at least 115 to 120 nations represented by a student body.
Mm-hmm.
I know there were multiple languages going into two, three dozen different languages were spoken in our high school. And so we taught history from an American point of view. Now, we had kids who were Ukrainian and Russian who had to listen to their home, their, you know, listen to us talk about their homeland. We had Native Americans who had to listen to the history of how America felt about Native Americans. You know, we had Africans and Middle Easterners, and oh, God, the kids that were from the Middle East, this was the late 80s, early 90s. You know, I remember being in high school because I graduated in 92, but being in school in 91 during the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Iraqi kids in school, oh, my God, they felt some type of way. It's like, look, we love America. You know, we're here. I don't think it's more or less them caring about people caring about kids having their feelings hurt in school. Is it more or less hurting white kids' feelings in school? Because the history has always hurt everybody's feelings, but there was one group who actually felt great about it. And I was reading a book. I'm reading a book. I haven't completed it yet. Called How the South Won the Civil War, which is really a good blueprint and seeing how the things that we talk about that are critical race theory got played out after the Civil War. because, you know, you see all of the policies that were put in place to try to oppress people who were finally getting some type of rights, and it just wasn't black. You know, you look in the West, there were Native Americans and Asian immigrants. You know, the Chinese caught hell in California and in Washington State and Oregon. And, you know, and we all caught hell. But, you know, particularly Native Americans, we don't really want to talk about our indigenous population and the stuff that with that, because that's been so, you know, ingrained into American culture. We played cowboys and Indians growing up.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody. Yeah. I mean, it's so ingrained in our culture that, oh, we're the good guys, we're the cowboys, the bad guys, and the Indians. You know, like,
yep.
Now you won't probably catch kids today playing that unless, you know, they're in a place where that kind of, you know, I ain't seen any kids in Atlanta playing in a long time, and I know my kids don't play it because it just ain't happening. But, you know, we have these cultural set points that none of us really thought about until we went through what we went through over the last 4 years. You know, seeing the resurgence of blatant, overt racism again. And then you had the publishing of the 1619 Project, which kind of brought this, you know, as you talked about it, you know, that this was something, critical race theory was something that was talked about in small groups, in academia, in graduate programs, and in law school. Unless you was working on a master's or a doctorate or a law degree, you probably wasn't exposed to any of this. Now that papers have been written and these papers have been publicized in major mainstream platforms, we're seeing this in discussion. And it's amazing to me how we have a certain group of people in this country, white supremacists, and people who are white supremacist adjacent, feel like their feelings are being hurt. It's like, really?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it takes everybody else to kind of stand up against it. I'm glad that you are an ally and a brother, you know, to this fight for equality and to educate us all equally. Because, I mean, it's something that is absolutely necessary for this country to fulfill the promise. We actually have to sit down and talk about this at some point in time. You know, South Africa had the, you know, their race reconciliation committee, their truth and reconciliation committee. They had to do it in Rwanda. And those are two African people, two groups of black people had to have a truth and reconciliation between each other because
yep.
of the ethnic strife. They've attempted it in the Balkans. I think at some point in time that the Israelis and the Palestinians need to deal with it. And the British and the French need to be sitting at the table with them because they ain't helped that happen. You know, but we have to have these important conversations in all places in the world, but particularly here in America, because if we don't, therefore I feel there are far-reaching implications that we don't even fathom. And do you have any, you know, feelings on that, of what that, we don't have these conversations, what can happen, and why it's important for us to, you know, if these conversations are going to happen, that we need to go ahead and have?
Well, you know, it's something that, you know, if we want to move forward and, you know, and have America fulfill that promise, which, you know, I think it's that American promise that people are thinking of when they write things or say things like America is not racist. America is not a racist country. I think that was in the state school board resolution, which, you know, from a historical perspective, is just nonsense, right? We started with genocide, and then we had slavery, and, you know, we haven't done that very well in most areas since. And, you know, until we can sit down and actually, you know, discuss the issue rather than pretending the issue doesn't exist, we're never going to get anywhere. I mean, people are just yelling, you know, talking points at each other. I'm not racist. And yes, there is racism, and we don't get anywhere.
So,
and,
what do you think is that?
You know,
so what do you think is the actual fear? What do you think is the actual fear?
So, I think it's tied up in this, you know, sort of zero-sum notion that, you know, a lot of people, white people, you know, struggle economically and fight for what they got, and they feel like, you know, they don't want to share that. You know, I don't think in most people it's a conscious thing, which is why we're getting so much backlash against it. But, you know, it's also hard because, you know, we're dealing with two different things. We're dealing with all this racism that's built into all of the systems we have. And we can't change and break out of those systems until we talk about it. But we also know that there's sort of all of that sort of unconscious racial decisions that we all make because, you know, we all grew up here in America in this system, you know, with those history textbooks and, you know, playing cowboys and Indians and doing all this stuff that, you know, that we know that when you send out identical resumes with different names, that white names get called for interviews and people with black names don't. And, I mean, in every area, we know there's all this stuff going on in our heads that we don't even know. And, you know, when people don't want to talk about that either because they don't want to think that they're like that, but it's, like, baked into us from the beginning. With our crazy system that we have.
So you feel like, it's, you know, a lot of it is just, you know, people not wanting to accept that they may have had an upper hand that was not based in their hard work and whatnot, and they're scared to just come to grips with that. Because I know
that's definitely part of it, yeah.
Because I know in the book that I was reading about how the South won the Civil War, is that that was a big political messaging strategy during the 1870s and 1880s in the West, that you can go out West and become your own man.
Mm-hmm.
You can go out there with use your own hands and you can make something of yourself. But when you look at the actual numbers, is that if there was anywhere in the country at any point in history that the government had more to do with increasing wealth of individuals, it was the building of the West. You was given land. You didn't have to buy it. It was given to you. So you did, wasn't like you saved your money and went out there and you bought all this land. You could go out there and get land free. The government gave subsidies. The government made sure that I didn't know that the army kept food stores and made sure food got distributed so these people were able to stay on their land. So there was a welfare safety net program administered by the United States Army. You know, but they kept preaching to people, oh, you're doing this by the work, you know, by the, you know, the hard work and through your hands and this, that, and the other. And black people were excluded from it. Native Americans were pushed on reservations because of it. Chinese immigrants didn't have even an ability to become even legal residents. It was like, you're here, we don't want you here, but we're going to include your labor. And then, even if you were able to get a piece of land and were able to work it, it was the best, what was most likely going to happen to you was some big landowner who was backed by a corporation who was using some type of extractive industry was going to take your land from you using the federal government and then make you work for them in some type of quasi-sharecropper form. Like, a lot of people were, you know, going to go farm, and then they found out, well, oh, there's possible gold under your land, and the gold mines come kick you off your land. You know, so, and but we don't talk about how rich white people have duped poor white people into supporting their pseudo-aristocratic lifestyle here in America. You know, we always talk about how proud America is of being a republic, this, that, and the other. When for the longest time, people have tried to make us very close to an English aristocratic association. You know what I'm saying? We've really tried to recreate having landed lords and manors here in the United States, but we've just done it through making sure that wealth is concentrated and that we get to dupe people into electing these elites into position so it looks like, okay, we have a choice of a people. And a lot of, I don't think some of that has been put into the whole race thing, because, again, nobody's looked at it. And you, like you said, these conversations are important to have, and particularly educating our children on it. And
well,
like
and,
you said, it's a big,
you know,
just been created too. Because I was listening to Fox News, and to me, it's starting to sound like this is their new common. This is their new common core fight.
Yeah, it's the big issue, and you know, and basically, you know, I would describe the having of these discussions and, you know, the talking about this history and how it's impacted us and, you know, right, that land expansion in the West was one example, the government involvement in, you know, construction of suburbs after World War II is another example in housing, you know, how all of these examples over the course of, history add up, and that's why, you know, black people were the first people to get in trouble with predatory lending in the early 2000s, and it's why, you know, the problem got ignored for so long. But, you know, these discussions, this is sort of the essence of critical race theory. What happened, and how does that impact us now? That's and to me, that's exactly what we should be teaching our kids how to do is look at information and analyze it critically. We talk about critical thinking as one of the core skills that we want our graduates to learn. And then, you know, the people who are complaining about cancel culture and freedom of speech on college campuses now want to ban the talking of, you know, critical thinking in this one area, which, you know, is pretty ironic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's infuriating at some point in time, because it's like we have you want to teach, you know, American exceptionalism, how America is the greatest country on the face of the planet Earth. And I don't disagree with America being one of the greatest countries that have existed on Earth. I don't disagree with that idea at all, because there's nothing in history that really looks like us. I mean, but the question is, there's a dark side to that. There's a history that goes along with our diversity. It isn't like it was wanted. You know what I'm saying? It just kind of happened And it happened in such a way that we don't want to act like we have classrooms, that we have cases. We don't want to act like we don't have any of that. Now, true enough, we're the greatest economic power to have existed in a long time. You know, we have one of the greatest militaries on the planet Earth. We can extend our power soft and hard to any corner of the planet and have people bend to our will. And I don't think, you know, people who celebrate those things, to me, it's really stupid that you would not want to harvest the pride of having a diverse nation. Because we've seen every time we go a little deeper into diversity, we get a little better, we get a little stronger. We wouldn't have had the Civil War would have been lost had not somebody said, you know what, black people want to fight too, let them fight. And then we kind of regressed and caught hell in a few other conflicts, and we again get on the point that we're going to lose. Let the minorities fight. Let the black people fight. World War II, we finally said, okay, we just going to stop. We push back. We just going to let it happen. And then we integrated our military, and that made us even stronger. Then we integrated our education system, in which ideas were starting to be able to commingle. And we became stronger. We were allowed to participate in the economy. And it became stronger. We were to tear down these barriers. It's nothing you can stop us from doing. Our limitations, me personally, in my opinion, I believe that the limitations of America are based on the fact that we're limiting the acceptance of our country's diversity, of truly trying to operate and become a post-racial nation. That we stop, you know, I would love before I leave this earth that I could go to the census and they just count me. They just count me.
Mm-hmm.
They're scout. And I don't have to go there. I'm scout. I'm African American. And I'm this, I'm that. I don't have to go through all of that. I would love an America where I'm just counted. Now today, I have to be counted, and I have to be counted in a certain way, because if I'm not, I'm going to lack representation. I'm not going to have a seat at the table to be able to push an agenda that will help us get to a point where I can just be counted. That should be the goal of everybody. Before you can do that, you got to, you know, you're an educator, you're a leader in your community, and you know that if there's a problem in the table, we got to address the problem before we can move forward. Why do we have hyphenated, you know, descriptors for our people? Why do we have African Americans? Why do we have Jewish Americans? Why do we have Arab Americans? Why do we have white Americans? Because the way our system is set up. Yeah, go ahead.
No, that, you know, finish up the thought.
I mean, I want to get your opinion on that one, because that's what I was leading to. That's what you were about to say. You know, because that's it. I mean, do you not feel that? Do you feel the same way I feel, or is there a difference in that? I mean,
yeah, so, you know, so somehow we have to, right, figure out, as, you know, this big experiment in a diverse democracy, you know, how do we deal with those issues? And, you know, when I was growing up and before that, we talked about this, you know, melting pot of America, you know, where all these people from different places came and sort of became American. But you know, I think in a lot of ways, you know, that was true for a lot of people's, you know, as they came to America. What that meant was they sort of got to start being the white people too, whether it was the Irish or the Italians or, you know, and, you know, and in some ways, you know, Black Americans were never included in that because they were excluded from the beginning. And right. So, you know, we don't want everyone to just necessarily homogenize and lose, you know, all of that history and culture of their people. But at the same time, we have to recognize that, you know, we all live in this country together, and it's not zero sum. Things, you know, the rising tide is all the boats. It's everyone, and we've got to make sure that that we're not leaving people behind, and we can't get to that if we don't acknowledge that we're not there yet.
Right.
You know, and you know, no, we're not there yet. Look at, you know, statistics and information and, you know, almost any area. And there aren't easy answers. And, you know, and it's going to be disruptive to a lot of people to figure out how to remake these systems so they're fair, because the systems are not, you know.
Right.
Ask anyone who has, you know, ever dealt with a policeman or a judge.
Right. Right. Like, for instance, Dan, like, you were talking about how, you know, when you first came on, that they just created the district that you in. Because my parents live in Riverdale, right across the line from Fayette County. They live in that little corner where you got Fulton, Fayette, and Clayton. And you can turn your head one direction, and when you're one of those three counties at any point in time. And,
I live right near there. Yep.
So, and the thing is that Fayette County to me is a wonderful place. I'm actually looking at my brick and mortar location for my business here in Georgia. I'm actually looking to put it in Fayette County. But, you know, you talk about that, and there's some of that, you know, because from my understanding, you know, you explain why did y'all have to have this district done, because that's a part of what we're dealing with, because from my remembrance, the Fed was really resistant to change. Explain to why that y'all had a case down there that ended up y'all having the school districts done like they were.
Yeah, so I think the lawsuit was filed in 2010, but, you know, the lawsuit was, you know, wasn't the first strategy that was tried to change the voting system in Fayette. And in Fayette, all of the voting for our county commissioners and our school board members was done at large. Which meant everybody in the county voted on all the positions. There were districts that, you know, the candidates had to live in and come from, but everybody in the county voted for everyone, which meant, you know, that the larger number of white voters concentrated, particularly in Peachtree City, where they are in Fayette, you know, got to control all of the elections because they got to vote in all of them. And so the predominant some citizens from the northern end of the county, which was more predominantly Black, to have people vote just by their district. And the Fayette County Commission and the school board, we probably spent combined I mean, I would guess more than $5 million of taxpayer money on attorneys trying to fight and keep an at-large voting system that was eventually, found by a judge to violate the Voting Rights Act. And, you know, this is all post the Voting Rights Act and pre-clearance and all that kind of stuff. But people were incredibly resistant to the idea of voting by districts. And through that process, Fayette County elected its first black county commissioner that they've ever had. And hopefully next year, if I don't plan to run again, we'll elect the first black school board member in Fayette County history. So it's made a huge difference in terms of, the conversations and the people that happen at the county government level, because it's not just one group controlling who gets elected, everyone elected.
Right. I mean, because, a lot of times we don't even look at those small local battles as being part of what we're talking about as a large construct. The fact that you have at-large voting districts in Georgia in 2021. Because Fayette wasn't the last. It probably was one of the last in the metro counties to get rid of that system, but there's still a lot of rural counties, I know, that have at-large systems. And with large black populations, they cannot get representation because of the way voting takes place. And that's a part of making sure that the resources that the government brings in is only spent on certain groups of people, because the other group doesn't have any representation to say, hey, can we get some funds over here for this? Can we get some funds for this? Can we get this in our neighborhood? They can't get it. And that hurts the development of those communities. And I've been watching the races, the municipal races in the city of Atlanta. I talked about it when I first came into the show there. And watching gentrification, and a lot of people look at gentrification and say, wow, the black people live in those communities are really pitching here. They are. But I would throw another dynamic in there. If I was white and I had to move into one of these communities, I would be mad. Because they talk back, they price gouging the hell out of white people. Seriously. These houses were maybe worth $60,000, $70,000, 5 years ago, if that. And now they're $500,000. $500,000. And the reason people are thinking that they can charge this is because, white people got money. It's because of that. In some cases. And if you want to see the neighborhood, I'm telling them, I'd be mad if I was white. Then I come over here and this house is $60,000 and now I got to pay $500,000 for it. I'm going to be mad at him. Because it seems like it works. Everybody's screwing everybody. You never allow the black people to get enough value in their home so they can produce wealth. And then, white people come in and they jack up the value of everything. Your taxes end up being higher, and then that's where you get all of these nuts on the right going, oh, you're taxing us for that. And in some cases, they might be right because you get gouged. And it's all because some fat cat developer is getting us. And we got us fighting each other, got these right wingers fighting the left over taxes. When your taxes went up because this developer came into this community, raped it, jacked up the prices, jacked up the value, now you paying for it, and somebody that's feeling the privilege is now complaining that you got to pay taxes. That some developer put you in that situation. Mm-hmm. I mean,
it chaps my ass. Just sit back and look at it. I mean, and you got all the little people are fighting each other while the big cats are sitting up at the top, getting rich and laughing at all of us. And we're fighting over teaching that we screwed, that they screwed us. That they screwed us.
Yeah.
It's about the poor. It wasn't the poor. It wasn't the poor Georgia farmer who didn't have slaves that was the problem. It was the big plantation landowners. That was the problem. That was the fool that started the Civil War. And then got the poor farmer to go fight it for him. Then when he came back, you tried to tell him because your plantation got burned down and they was going to take your little shack. Nobody was worried about your shack. We wanted all that land that plantation houses on. But you made the poor whites feel like they had a stake in the game. And they didn't. You still don't.
Yeah, it's and that's a, you know, one of the points in that Sum of Us book is, you know, the rich people will tend to use these, you know, racist themes and race as an issue to get poor whites to focus on that. And you know, the truth is that just numbers-wise, there's more poor whites than there are poor blacks that get hurt by these policies that get formed, you know, through these racist political methods. And
right.
It is. It's the haves keeping the have-nots fighting each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like I said, it's just really just, it chaps me. It chaps me because I'm sitting there and going, okay. It's just crazy because people are, it's kind of like, Al Tanell, right?
Say it again.
You know Al Tanell, right? Fulton County, Jim Rapparan's boyfriend.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but he's doing a project, Rediscovering the American Dream or whatever. It was really interesting where they've been asking different people about the American Dream. And I did a set for that. And I watched some of the other clips that they had, the people that they interviewed. And I really love the idea of the American Dream. I do. Of you being able to get a good education and then using your education to either get a good paying job or being able to go out there and work on your own. Being able to follow your passion. I think that's the biggest thing in America, being able to go out there and follow your passion. That should be the goal for every American, is to be able to go follow your passion. And it's amazing that, you know, that we spend so much time crushing passion. I mean, and as an educator, you know, out here trying to educate a very diverse population and dealing with this kind of stuff where they don't want you know, people above you, like the state government, trying to tell you that you can't teach these children the truth so that they can eventually go find their passion. How mad does that make you? Does it make you mad? If it does, how mad does it make you?
No, I mean, you know, it's infuriating that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we have all this fake outrage about critical race theory, which people don't understand, and, you know, which it is hurting efforts in our school system and in all school systems to, you know, help fix some of the racist systematic things that are that have been built in from a long time, whether it's, you know, historically who's been allowed to be teachers and who can train to be teachers, to, you know, who the people we learn about in history class, to who we read about in English class. I mean, all of those things need working on, as our, right? The other thing we haven't talked about is our country is becoming more diverse. Right, you know, Fayette County is about 2/3 white overall, but less than half of our students are white. And, you know, there's some generational stuff that plays in there too. But, you know, we have to figure out how to live and work with each other. And, you know, everyone yelling at each other about their own personality and whether they feel racist or not, and don't make my kid feel racist. I mean, it's not getting us to solving problems and helping kids.
Right.
And it's not very good modeling for our kids either. Right? We want to model. We want our kids to learn how to grow up and have difficult conversations civilly and be able to critically talk about things and all of that. And then, you know, if we can as adults do it and model it, then for sure we can't expect our kids to do it later.
So I got people asking, am I taking calls today? All right. Yeah, I will take a couple of calls today. The number is 563-999-3030. If you want to call in, we'll take a couple of calls before we switch over to Colonel Thornton, which will be coming on here about 10:11. So between that, we can take some calls. So if you want to call in today, the number is 563-999-3030, and the lines are open. So if you want to call me. But you know, it's a really interesting situation that, like you said, we would want to model something different for our children. You know, having difficult conversations, but it's also about being accountable for how you make other people feel in your space. You know, even if you're not willing to hold people accountable for something you do on a national scale, how apt are you to want to be held accountable on a personal scale? You know, because we as human beings, we have interactions with each other daily. And those interactions got to be played out, so we got to call them. Good morning, Carl. Yep. Welcome to Downside with City.
Hi, Scout. Hi, Leonard. This is Terry from Columbus.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey. Yeah, like, I just wanted to touch on y'all, this is a good show today, and I just had a few things to say about how write a lot of this down, regarding the current rage over CRT, critical race theory, and yeah, like it just reminds me of all that's been happening in not just here in the U.S. but like in other countries, like for example how in like other countries right now, like say in European countries and some Latin American countries, they're not raging as much over CRT as they are raging over what they call gender ideology, which is basically like, gender identity, like, it should not be a thing. It should be a binary and what have you. And they're raging over that really hard, and it's, like, the same sort of moral panic as what we're seeing right now with CRT and academia, and it's, like, here in the United States. But I guess it's, like, it just takes more, it gets more credence here right now, especially because, you know, Biden won, and they can't think Biden, so President Biden, so this is how they're trying to, like, further cement their control and everything within education, the educational sector. So just a bunch of things.
You know, usually there's a dynamic here, a progression. We talk about race, and then we start talking about sexual orientation, gender definition, things of that nature. It always kind of moves in that direction. And how we deal with this particular issue of dealing with race is going to set the tone of how we deal with people, how they identify themselves. I mean, because the thing is that we've learned over time that our binary construct doesn't cover everyone. And even if you study history and you look at different cultures, everybody is not always used a binary gender defining system. You know, you look at history where you have cultures where there's just not men and women. The Native Americans had a two-spirit person. You know, you had a lot of societies that really didn't have any gender definitions at all past reproduction. And so we have to understand that a lot of this stuff is modern construct we put in ourselves in. And it's based on a very narrow view of the world. And so how we deal with critical race theory is how we're going to deal with probably in the critical gender theory. I have relatives who are want to be nonconforming. And what easy for me to just use their names instead of using the pronouns. You know, instead of saying he, she, or her, I just call them by their name. That's your designated. It's just your name. You know, if I'm going to talk about you, I'm not going to say it or them. It's like, okay, Joey. Joey was da-da-da-da. Joey this and Joey that. Or whatever, you know, that's how you do that. And if we be accepted, we have to learn that all of this stuff is tied in. Our world is changing. We're learning more about who we are as human beings. And it should be embraced. And I understand that a lot of people are scared, but how you choose to define your personal decision, you know, and how you choose to interact with the corporate decision amongst your group. So if you like gender conforming, you know, definitions, then let that be what it is and be all right with it. Listen to this next caller is, and I appreciate you calling in, Eric, because that was really, really a good a point that you made.
Thank you.
Good morning, caller. How are you doing?
Scout, this is Ulta Thornton. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, Kurt?
Nothing much, sir. Just enjoying the good life.
Enjoying the good life. We got Fed County School Board member, Lynn Pressfield, on the line with us also. He's been on for a good portion of the show. Lynn, if you got something to do, you go on for some things to go on the show. We can talk about this. We can do so.
I do have to run, but it has been a pleasure, and you know, always happy to do it. And you know, if anyone has any questions, look me up, give me a call, send me an email. Happy to talk with you.
All right. Well, we appreciate you, Linda, and thank you for supporting the show.
All right. Thanks, Scout. See ya. All right.
Yeah. See you. So Carol Thornton, tell everybody, introduce yourself, tell everybody who you are. I kind of gave it to not early on in the show of who was going to be coming on, but I might need to tell the whole story. So
okay. First of all, Brother Smith, I appreciate you for all that you're doing in the community, in the state, to move things better, make lives better for other people. I'm a eighth generation Georgian from a little place called Elberton, Georgia. I've lived during my life in Elberton, Augusta, Savannah, Richmond Hill, and now I'm in Noonan, Georgia. But I went to Morehouse College here in Atlanta, graduated in 89, and then went on to the military for 21 years, where I served all over the world. Last two assignments were the White House in Iraq. I worked for President Obama and also President Bush before him as a communications officer and director of personnel for the agency at the time. After I retired, I had been working with the National PT on the national board like a couple of years before retirement. They asked me to consider the presidency of National PTA, which is the oldest child advocacy organization in the country. And I served as president from 13 to 15, first African-American male in 123-year history. And I continued to work with the White House and Congress on education policy, and I played a critical role in the passage of the Every Student Succeeds Act, which is the federal law now that governs all public schools in America. And so that's basically it in a nutshell. Like I say, just enjoying life right now and out and about working.
You left out something very important.
What is that?
That you were the 2018 Democratic nominee for state school superintendent.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And right now, yeah. And Brother Scott, I'll tell you right now, a lot of people have been hitting me up on that. And what I'm telling people is I am closely following the courts on whether they're going to overturn the laws that Georgia passed in SB 202, because that's going to be that's going to wreak havoc, I think, on the Democratic Party getting elected in Georgia if we don't get those laws overturned.
We're talking critical racism, and
okay,
me and you were having a conversation. We were having a conversation earlier in the week about this, and you were talking about some writing that had taken place, and some articles and things that you had taken part in, and I'm sure you have an opinion that is weighted inside of some research that you would like to share. So tell us what you think, what your thoughts are on critical race theory.
Okay, well, first of all, if you don't master communication, communication will master you. And we have, the Republican Party in America, they've mastered communication as far as owning the communication and controlling the communication. So critical race theory, so people will know, and please research for yourself, don't take my word, originated with Dr. Derrick Bell out of Harvard University. And there are a couple other professors that have done a lot of work in this area. And in this theory, it's basically a theory on the racial injustices and things that have happened in history that has established institutional racism and disenfranchised, you know, basically people of color. That's the theory in a nutshell. So when that theory is applied in schools, that theory applied says, what is the true history of chattel slavery? What is the economic impact that it had on us? And you know, like the Tulsas, the Atlanta race riots, what impact did those actions have upon current day, what we're living in now? So with the critical race theory, what Governor Kemp and Republicans are concerned about is that as we start teaching our kids about their true history. I'm going to digress just for one moment. like I'll give you an example. You know, most kids are taught in schools that the cradle of civilization is the Middle East or Europe. And the truth or the fact of the matter is civilization began in Africa. And modern-day scientists will tell you the oldest mitochondrial DNA was traced back to an African woman near Lake Tanzania by Dr. L.S.B. Leakey. So that's the type of things that our kids are not being taught in school. So they believe that Africa is a dark continent and nothing came out of Africa, but, you know, you have the pyramids and civilization coming out of there. So those are my initial thoughts. I'll say this and I'll be quiet, you know, so any questions. I must applaud Georgia Parent Teacher Association. They elected a Caucasian sister this weekend that I guess the post says she's woke. So she will be putting out a statement this week on Georgia PTA's position on critical race theory. And Shonda Ross, she's a Howard University graduate. She's the president-elect, so she'll take office 2 years from now. So I really look forward to some positive things in Georgia PTA fighting the power to make sure that our kids get a proper education and critical race theory integrated where it needs to be integrated into our school systems.
Okay. So this is the first question I got for you, because we were talking about the impacts of chattel slavery and what we're dealing with now and that not being taught. And as I was telling Leonard beforehand, there's a book that I'm reading right now, How the South Won the Civil War. Now, I know you could probably catch some of these things in a different light because of your military background. You know, because every time you mention this book to somebody, it's like, no, the South didn't win. The North won that war. No, they won on the battlefield, but they moved ideological situation. And you know from a military standpoint how important it is to win the psychological battle and the political battle after the fight is over.
That is correct.
So my question
that is
you,
correct.
So my question to you, you know, the Civil War was the critical point in our history in which we could have changed a lot of things, but we failed to do so. So my question to you is, how important is it that we go back and research and reteach that history so we understand stuff like, you know, the 40 Acres and the Mule and Sherman's general order that actually formulated the idea of the 40 Acres and the Mule? And the follow-up question behind that, and how does that deal, how much of this you think is dealing with opposition to reparation?
Okay. So, Scott, excellent question. So, first of all, if you go back and look at history, okay, let's take standard classroom teaching. Okay, the Civil War happened between 1861 and 1865. Based upon that battle, Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and they began their journey in America towards their freedom in a positive sense. And they put the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to handle things. Now, that's to help blacks and the newly freed Africans to maneuver in America. Here's a critical race, talk from a critical race theory and practice perspective. It would be the Civil Wars fought 1861 to 1865. That they were freed because President Lincoln wanted to maintain the Union. And he figured by doing that, as slavery was expanding in the country, he wanted to keep the Union together. Therefore, he really wasn't against slavery, but again, he wanted to preserve the Union, so that's why we did the Civil War. Now, the Southern legislators, with the 13th Amendment, remember, it gave us our freedom, but it said, you know, we could be put in servitude, you know, for crimes as criminals. So this is slavery 2.0. If you look at it from a critical race theory, and if you look at the prison industrial complex today, that's what we have. So that's the history we don't look at. And we see as laws began to develop and we began to grow, African-Americans, they moved from chattel slavery to, convict leasing. And like I said, mass incarceration to the day. So that's an evolution that's been not being taught in schools. Because, you know, so it's those type things that if you don't teach it from a proper and objective historical perspective, and to your questions, reparations with the 40 acres and the mule, once we were freed, a lot of the southern plantation owners were compensated for the loss of their land and slaves as property. And for African Americans, although they had put in there that, you know, we were going to get this thing, they canceled that. So if you look at different populations in this country, the Japanese American citizens that were interned during World War, II, they were compensated. So it's a lot of different populations. What we're seeing are receiving reparations or some type of compensation for the things that our government has done. Martin Luther King, I think one of the reasons he was assassinated towards the end in 1968, he really went hard on the Vietnam War and the military-industrial complex and the money that it was making and lives it was putting in jeopardy. He was talking about economics. He was talking about education and housing, those critical things. And I think that was a form of reparations, him pushing for those things, but those very things cost him his life.
As you can, I don't know. I was watching the movie Jesus and the Black Messiah.
I saw that. Beautiful movie.
It's always interesting to me that
mm-hmm.
when we start talking about changing
mm-hmm.
the economics
mm-hmm.
of this country to benefit everybody, including
yep.
African Americans, that people start dying.
That is correct.
Talking about voting is one thing. Talking
mm-hmm.
about civil rights is another. But when we start talking
mm-hmm.
about economic engine working for everybody, including African Americans,
mm-hmm.
we start having problems. Because, one of the things that I've noticed is that the foundations of critical race theory, one of the things you find in the lessons that you learn from hearing those truths is that
mm-hmm.
it has always been the rich landed individuals who
mm-hmm.
have pitted the poor, regardless of what ethnic group they came across, against each other so that we can't share.
Yep.
And there's enough wealth in this country. America, and like I was telling Linda before, I truly believe that America is the greatest country on the face of the planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yep.
of our economic power, our diversity, our military, what we keep not doing is not embracing our diversity, not bringing it all together. Because every time we come a little closer to bringing it together, we actually become a richer nation. The more people we
That's
bring
correct.
Into the economy, we become a richer nation. Because our GDP goes up because that more of these people participate. But,
yeah.
So, just say it, rich white people or someone
mm-hmm.
say rich and white, that they
mm-hmm.
don't care nothing about it, as long as they can live in their big house, because southern planters were very well prepared to continue to live in a South that was unindustrialized, dirt
mm-hmm.
roads. They don't care as long as they can live in their house and go do what they do and nobody bother them.
Brother Smith, let me clarify when we communicate things. And I'm speaking to you as a combat veteran that have come under fire. America is the greatest country based upon, the ideals are the greatest. Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. But again, looking at history, it didn't do people right. But the ideals, and people say, well, how can you fight for a country that exploited your people? And be, well, no, I'm fighting for the ideals of America, that we can have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that we can have freedom of speech, freedom of religion. That's for, and brother, you're a veteran. You fought for that too.
Right.
And so I think we have to keep that in mind. And but check this out. I think it's very Yep. I think our people, we just need to continue to encourage our people to economically, like you say, that is dangerous, because when you get yourself in a position economically, that's freedom. But if they can control your income, control where you live, how you live, you lose that freedom. And brother, I will tell you, I do work. Well, I'm retired, but you know, I still do a little something. But I mean, I meet people that make, like in a day, in a week, make $50 million, $100 million. So that's how, money is out there. But we just don't have access as African Americans to that, and we just have to create ways and things to make access for our people to help them reach that economic freedom to make sure they build their communities where our children are.
You're right. I mean, we have to, and we, to me, in my opinion, that we have to teach the truth to be able to get past it, and so we can understand that, you know, our country is diverse. It is what our diversity is probably one of our greatest resources, because unlike every other nation in the world, we can tap every cultural, traditional idea that exists on the planet Earth and bring it to bear under one flag. Every other they're limited in that idea. You know, everybody can be an American. Everybody can be everything else. We can't be everything else, but everybody can be an American. You know, and it's about us embracing that idea. There's a child sitting in the Central African Republic that is wanting to come to this country that has an idea that we can't even fathom because of his life experience, and he can come here to America, get an education, and take this experience he had and turn it into a $1 billion idea that could change the world. There's a child in Norway that has an idea from their experience to come to America and turn that into a $1 billion idea. There's a child sitting on an island in Micronesia that can do the exact same thing. There's a child sitting in Southwest Atlanta, black child sitting in Southwest Atlanta, who, because of the traditions and the experiences they have, if given the proper opportunity here in the country that they were born in, has a $1 billion idea. And, you know, we have to just have all the stuff we've been thinking about to make that happen. Now, see, now I'm mad because I missed the show, a 90-minute show, and we about to get this. But I appreciate you coming on. I look forward
to
coming on the show. You know, as we got other things that I know that you are really knowledgeable on to talk about. And, you know, let's keep the dialogue rolling, people, because this just ain't something we should talk on Dialogue 30. Let's keep this dialogue going on out there in the internet space, you know, in the coffee shop. Let's keep all these conversations going, because as long as we keep educating each other, the more we learn, the better we can resist.
Well, Brother Smith, I would just want to say this. I want to insert this. One of the things that we did, and I think I mentioned it to you, Georgia Parent Teacher Association this weekend passed a resolution. The delegates. We have 76,000 members here in Georgia, and they actually passed a resolution, which the president will be putting it out this week, on critical race theory, so that the parents of the association and folks involved can really push and really deal with this resolution passed by the Georgia Board of Education. And I'm very proud of them. And like I said, that will hopefully keep the conversation moving. And not only conversation, brother, but action. You know, and those actions right. will make a difference and make the education better for our kids here in Georgia.
Well, that's good to hear. And we're glad to hear that an organization like PTA is passing a resolution to make sure that our children are learning what they need to be learning. Everybody,
yeah.
It was a great show. I appreciate all of our guests. I appreciate our caller. This is Down South and Dirty, people. We'll see you not next Sunday, but the Sunday after that, because we're on a bi-weekly schedule now. And we'll see you then. We're out. Peace.